Hello and welcome to Walkley Talks. I'm James Gorman from the Walkley Foundation for Journalism. Here we share discussions about the craft and importance of journalism in Australia and the world, often recorded at our events. Today's podcast is from our Regional Journalism Summit held earlier in 2022. The New Wave is a panel discussion highlighting innovative business models to support regional and local journalism. This talk was recorded as part of the Walkley Regional Journalism Summit on February 10.
Welcome to what I'm sure will be an inspiring and aspirational panel. It's about the new wave in regional journalism, and new waves are generally associated with a break in the traditional way of doing things and generally can follow periods of upheaval and disruption. It made me think of the 70s and 80s when punk rock came along. It totally disrupted the music scene at the time, and then what followed was the new wave, which was still innovative, but way more accessible. So Australian regional media has certainly had a big period of disruption in recent years, and we're all too familiar with that. It's left untold communities without any source of local news, stories and accountability. But in good news, there have been some really bold and courageous people who have got behind regrowing media services in regional areas. Some of those are innovative, some not so much. But are they sustainable? And that's the question. And I want to explore that today with this panel. And I'd like to introduce three people who have decades of experience in journalism and credibility, and they're part of the new wave of regional journalism. They are Annabelle Hickson from Galah Magazine, Simon Creera from PS Media, and Tony Gillies from Public Interest News Service. Simon, if we can just go to you first. Could you describe the regional media landscape at present? Are there green shoots in news deserts?
Thanks, Kathy. And it's great to be on this panel and be talking about this issue. Yeah, look, I think overall what we've heard today, what we know is that ultimately journalism is in crisis, that basically the business model has been under immense pressure for a couple of decades, the traditional print newspaper business model. And through that, what we're seeing is communities really suffering. There's an increasing lack of information where it's necessary, particularly in regional communities. There's increasing polarization that's been driven by the platforms. And really, like the old model of service to communities is really broken. As we've heard today, there's been a huge loss of publications. Basically, prior to the pandemic, there'd been about 100 local newspaper closures over 10 years. Through the periods starting with the pandemic in 2020, we've seen more than 244, I think Anna from Pidgey said today. But so that's, you know, it's major, it's profound, and it's impacting on hundreds of communities around Australia. What has been exciting, I think, in that period as well, is that as Pidgey mapped, there have been expansions. There's been a launch of hyperlocal publications around Australia. Often journos who've left these papers that have closed or there's been redundancies. And I think that that's encouraging, that there's evidence that there's actually people willing to give it a go and to try and serve their communities. I think the caveat to that is what we've seen it overseas and what is measured in the News Deserts reporting that's been running for 5 years in the US is that many of those hyperlocal startups, particularly the really small ones, they quite quickly run out of the ability to keep themselves going. They've got a lot of focus on journalism, less on their sustainable business models.
So does disruption herald good innovation? Because that doesn't sound like it's good innovation. That sounds like doing more of the same thing. Or does it need assistance to become sustainable innovation?
Yeah, I mean, I think the pandemic, it's been an existential shock for everyone, right? And I think that therefore, you know, the emergence of these hyperlocal publishers shows that disruption equals innovation. You know, people have, you know, they've lost local news, and some people have tried to come in and solve that. So I think that is very encouraging. But I think that the realities are that the market forces that have placed great threat on the provision of public interest journalism, they're not gone away. And the digital advertising that's dominated by the big players is still like this big problem for sustainability. So I think, the worry is that as we go back into a kind of new normal, that basically, that same issues that made the previous decade a real challenge for publishers will also be there And, you know, they're going to still have to fight for attention. For, you know, it's attention is a big issue for any publisher, and everybody's got so many distractions plus the advertising dollars. It's very hard to get them. So I do think, yeah, there's, you know, I think some assistance and some of the things we've heard today, some of the journalism fund the government are proposing if re-elected, et cetera, et cetera. I think those things are going to be necessary. And that's what we're seeing internationally, that it requires a whole load of contributors to try and support the Berlin regional space.
So we'll come to some of your ideas a little bit later on in the panel where, you know, that extra support and collaboration, I guess. But Tony, if I can go to you next. As the former head of AOP, you probably know more about the regional importance of Newswires than anybody else in Australia. How is the public interest news service concept that you're putting forward different from that?
Yeah, look, I think what it answers, and I'll, if you want me to explain roughly what it is very quickly, the public interest news service is a concept at the concept stage, but it seeks to deliver real-time reporting of ordinary general meetings of local councils. It does it in an independent way. It's free of bias, and it's underpinned by the principles of balance, accuracy, and fairness, as a newswire would be, and then this content is then made available to bona fide media right around the country at no cost. So there's the difference there. You really need to be able to support this media in another way. Funding what I'm proposing comes from the fees that would be generated from local councils themselves, not to actually pay for the content itself, but for access and distribution of the content. And there's a difference there, because the public interest newswire really needs to be independent, sit at arm's length from everything else, be completely protected in its independent ethos to deliver all of that really strong, strident content. The councils wouldn't have any influence over that, but what they would get as a result of it is they wouldn't get a free kick, but they'd get a fair go in their reporting. And what I've seen right around is, and I've been looking into this whole matter for a long time, is there seems to be a lack of time or an inclination to do this type of reporting consistently. And that's generally, you know, there are some media organisations that are, media outlets that are doing it well, but many don't have the time or inclination to be able to do it. And what happens as a result of that, democracy is not really well served at all, you know, and you only have to look at the number of, council mayors and general managers and so on who are being investigated for inappropriate conduct. So, you know, there seems to be this lack of scrutiny on some public institutions at that critical time, and therefore a lot of stuff happens under the cover of darkness. That's why this stuff's important. And councils themselves, you know, the ones I've spoken to many, they see the value in this. They need to get, and they're obligated to get news of their activities out there to the communities.
Some of them have started their own services.
Correct, yeah. But they, you know, and it's interesting, even those people or even those councils recognise the poor optics of that. You know, you need something independent. And if in the absence of media being able to do it itself, you know, we sort of need to step in here. And really that's what's behind the public interest news service.
Well, that's a very innovative concept. Now to you, Annabelle, Galah magazine is also both bold and innovative, so it fits right into that whole new wave. It's thriving and without advertising. How? Why? What have you done to make that work?
Well, Kathy, it's very nice to hear you use the words bold and innovative, because I've heard a lot of other words to describe starting a print magazine with no ads in 2021. I mean, people just thought I was bonkers. They said I was crazy. The magazine was doomed. This is absolutely impossible. But, I mean, I wasn't sure whether it would be possible, but I had a hunch, and I think I was able to do it because before I decided to print anything, I had an existing audience on social media, and it was through that people were telling me that they wanted sort of a new publication for regional Australia, something that sat in between news and the lifestyle, you know, a new thing And so I knew there were people interested, and I also knew that they really loved print. I mean, I love print. I love reading something that doesn't need a pen. I love lying in bath without fear of electrocution, you know, and there were other people who I knew felt the same. But whether they were going to actually put their money where their mouth was, that was going to be a different question. So I kind of put together the first issue of this print magazine. And then before I did anything else, I launched pre-orders. So people, I sort of worked out retrospectively how much it was going to cost me. And I sort of figured if I could sell 3,000 copies at $30, so a really high cover price for, you know, most magazines, that I'd be able to pay pretty much all my costs for that one. And I did it. So by the time I printed, there was actually no risk. So I didn't think I was crazy at all. I mean, what I was fearful that I wasn't going to deliver a product that met, you know, the expectations, but that I seem to have passed the test on that. And Galah's thriving. We're working on issue 5 now, and we've increased our print run. You know, we've increased our revenue. All these trends of downward revenue and downward print runs, it's sort of not applicable to us at the moment. I mean, I hear so many people talking about how difficult the transition is from print to digital, but in a way, I kind of went about it completely the opposite. I went from digital to print. So there we go.
So you realised that there was a demand there that was being unmet, and you discovered that through social media platforms, through your social media presence. Definitely. And you built it and they came, pretty much.
Yeah, that's it. I feel like I almost put a flag in the sand and said, right, here is this space for people who are interested in regional Australia, for people who think regional Australia is exciting. I'm pretty sure you're out there. You know, will you come? And they've come.
Simon, now to you, audience interaction and engagement on social platforms was important for BuzzFeed when you were there. So what will that interaction look like with your PS media model for startup newsrooms? So you can explain the model there, if you like, and how that would work.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. And I think, have we got a slide? Are we showing slides, or is that part of the plan?
I'm not sure what's happening with the slides. We do have them.
Fine. Okay. All right. Well, you know, like fundamentally, somebody's going to share a slide, I think.
Here we go.
Drum roll. Okay. Yeah. So this is the, can we see that? Yeah. So this is the PS media business model. It's local, it's collaborative, yours. And really the concept of what we're trying to do first and foremost is about building trust with the communities that we serve. And for us, that's about starting with listening. So what we're seeing, this is really, to answer your question, Kathy, around our audience interaction, our engagement approach, is really first and foremost about listening to communities. And what we've seen internationally is that increasingly successful journalism startups are basically building their businesses around a community-first approach. So what we seek to do is fundamentally, first of all, understand intensely the information needs of that community, the one we seek to serve, and then work with them basically to solve those problems by co-creating a platform for change. So the idea is that this is hyper-local and relevant to you, and that's where it's local, and that you're really involved and included in this process, and that gives you a sense of belonging to this thing and also a sense of power, because you can see your voice and you can see your stories told. It's very collaborative, but the community are really going to, be very involved in participating and sharing their insights. And the idea at scale, as we grow this out into communities that want it, is this creates an ecosystem where this collaborative approach really works. It's a kind of feedback loop where we're learning about the approaches that are serving community best, and we can share that with communities around Australia. And the final piece is that it's yours. We're going to put this in the hands of our communities. We're going to ask them to build it with us. So what we want to do is have them.
Simon, you've just dropped out briefly.
I really wanted to hear that part about co-ownership.
Well, we might come back to Simon in a moment, and I can move on to Tony. Tony, and we might also be able to show your slide here. Was it for the public interest news service concept, was it demand or need that prompted you to come up with it?
Yeah, I think in the first instance it was need, as I saw it, and I don't mean that to sound conceited at all. It's just that having spent so much time in this regional space looking to assist the industry, you could actually see where the issues were. And, you know, much to the, the same principles that Simon's, addressing through the PS Media project, it sort of recognises that there's a time pressure on local media like never before. Newsrooms are so scantily resourced and so they can't get to the things sometimes that they really need to. So, addressing that part and addressing this lack of scrutiny over public institutions, I think actually served the need or saw where the gap was. Subsequent to that, then, it's really then been about, okay, well, let's see what the parties think about all of this, the parties involved here. And so I spent a lot of time with local government groups to understand their appetite for this and to really sort of dig deep under why they would actually want to be involved. Would they be willing to, fund such a thing? And clearly, they do recognise the need to do that. In fact, there's been a couple of councils who asked me to submit to the federal government inquiry into regional, into regional media recently, just pushing this thing along. So there really is an appetite from local media, from local councils. And then on the other side with media, and look, it's only anecdotal, but I have spoken to a number of media publishers as well, and I said, well, okay, if we can trust it, if we know that it's independent, if we know that it's free of bias and the quality is good, of course, we would use that because you got me at free. And that's not to sound twee, it's just really, it does serve a need in that respect. So my next steps with this is to really, pull those, turn that appetite into something a little more substantial. I've created a business model around all of this and it does all work and it uses local journalists and all of those sorts of things. So there's a lot of wins here. These coming weeks and months are now quite telling for this initiative.
So you would employ local journalists who would use sort of the council streaming services to cover council meetings? Is that how it would work?
Correct. Yeah. And it'd be a combination of, freelancers that would be well trained. I mean, that's the issue here. There'd need to be a publishing mission that sits behind, and there is indeed a publishing mission that sits behind this initiative. And that is to, it is all about that balance, accuracy, fairness, and it's about perspective in journalism as opposed to, immediately going for the jugular and going for the most controversial piece in there. But, with the right mindset, and the capacity to deliver content in real time, which is this, and that's a real newswire skill to do that well. That's what this is about. So it's partially about training and it's partially about, employing, local journalists. And of course we'll have, our own, reporters and editors as well pushing this content out there. So that's the other important piece.
Just returning now to you, Simon, because we lost you there for a moment and you were about to tell us about how the co-ownership model would work in the community, that it would belong to the community and that's how it would work. Can you expand on that for us, please?
Yeah, the idea here is that what we're seeing internationally, that trends that are working well, and here in Australia too, is the growth of businesses where a key part of their revenue stream is subscription or sometimes membership, which is kind of deeper than subscription. And membership is certainly more about belonging. Subscription is still pretty transactional. You're not getting too much out apart from access to a particular thing. We want, and our value proposition is really about, we believe fundamentally there should be no paywall, that this news that we provide should be freely accessible to everyone. But we also recognise that in order to give the community a sense of belonging to it, and a sense of really feeling that they're deeply participating, the ownership would give them that sense of connection. And so, the core value proposition for an owner is they will buy a share in our business. We need somewhere between, 0.5 to 3% of the community to do that, depending on the size of the community that we're serving. A very small.
How much would membership be?
Well, we're an early stage startup about to run pilots, but our current plan is that we would ask people to buy a $500 share in the business, which they would pay for over 4 years. And the idea there is that they would pay $125 a year or $10, $50 or whatever to pay for it monthly. You compare that against what you would pay to access a newspaper digitally online, several hundred dollars a year at least, and you don't kind of get anything back. It's quite transactional. Our co-owners will deploy our platform to really deeply assist us in terms of the direction of what we're doing and provide real direction, and they'll have agency and control. And ultimately, the plan is that once we're profitable, we will deploy the platform to return the profit back into all communities, and the co-owners will determine how it's spent locally. So they will be able to use the platform, and it's basically a social enterprise. They will be able to say, okay, well, there's an issue with our local school. We want to support it. Something's wrong with the health of our local river, or we want to clean up our beach. And that they would be able to determine an initiative where they would actually be able to give funds. And that's a kind of a thing we're seeing with lots of successful non-media businesses out there. Who Gives a Crap, et cetera. Thank You Nappies. They're all doing good for society. Our business intends to do good for the communities that we serve.
And what stage are you at? Is it beyond concept yet, or have you piloted it?
Yeah, we're piloting this year. So we're piloting effectively very, very shortly in three communities. And so we've selected the communities. No, they're in. There's no out and out regional. The most regional communities, they're local communities. But what I started with this initiative, really thinking about regional Australia, the realization with a lot of research that we've done is that actually there's news deserts in the middle of our biggest cities, in particular in the suburbs and urban fringes. So we're testing in an inner city location, a suburban location, and a location that moves into regional outside one of our biggest cities in Queensland. And so that's, we're testing it in different markets and really different population sizes as well. It's important for our model that we can, there's a certain size of community, and we've heard today it's almost too small to support local news unless it's maybe government supported or something that we may see in coming years.
To you, Annabelle, what's next for Galah in your terms of development? Do you keep doing what you're doing because it's working, or do you see a need to broaden that offering so that it will be sustainable into the future?
Well, Cathy, just after hearing Simon talk about co-ownership, my head is spinning. I think that sounds really exciting. I mean, before Simon, we have to speak more about this after. But before I knew that was a thing, the plans for Galah, we really do want to look into the membership model. And that's probably why I got so excited hearing about co-ownership, because I think, four issues down the track, I think what I've realised is that more than a magazine, Galah is sort of this community of people who are interested in things that the magazine talks about. So at the moment we make a magazine for this group, but in the future we could do all sorts of other things for the group. I mean, to me, the real sort of value and what I get most excited about is bringing this group together. I don't know how to say it in ways that don't sound cheesy, but it's all sort of this community that I think is the exciting part. So I do plan to keep the magazine going because I think it's sort of a really, really sort of sets the stage for what we're all about and kind of attracts birds of a feather. We are going to start working on a book with a publisher, a hardcover book that will come out probably towards the end of next year. So I think that'll be a really great way to access, to sort of get the Galah brand out there to overseas markets. We can't ship our magazines overseas. It's just crazy expensive. But this book would be a really great way to get in into things like that, but not just overseas, into other markets in Australia. So we're going to be that sort of next on the scene too. But really, the membership's what I'm really, really excited about. And in cahoots with that, we'd want to really invest in some tech. At the moment, we just have a very simple Shopify site that we've made ourselves. But we really want to sort of ramp that up a bit so that members could have access not only to our magazine, but to all sorts of digital stuff like videos of interviews with really interesting people. We have dreams to have a big kind of interactive map. So if you jumped in your car and you wanted to do a road trip from Lismore to Bourke, you'd know where to eat. There'd be a really curated sort of list of where to eat, where to stay. But more importantly, it would also kind of geotag stories that we've written to sort of give you some deeper context. So it's not just a travel guide. You get to kind of read about the people who actually live here. So that could be really exciting, but that's quite expensive. So we're just sort of working out how to do all that. But I really feel like our audience and our readers are so engaged. They're already kind of showing signs of wanting to head towards membership and, I mean, now possibly even co-ownership. I mean, nothing would excite me more.
A lot of very bold thoughts there. Tony, what stage are you at? Like, you're at concept stage and you've talked to lots of councils, and I'm just intrigued that they actually want the scrutiny. I think that's fabulous that they do. But what stage are you at with bringing the concept to fruition?
So we've done a number of, and it's great that this slide is up, because we have done a number of proofs of concept, covered a number of council meetings just to ensure that it works. And I must say there is just obviously such a rich seam of content there that would be available. What you're seeing in the screen in front of you, though, is how we would tackle this, or how we are tackling this. And, you know, and I see as, you know, when you get the agenda for a council meeting, there's usually about, 20, 25 items on the agenda, but that's not where the coverage starts. Obviously, there are previews, and you can see in the minus 24 hours that, we would be, publishing a couple of previews, and then in this whole real time or, fast delivery of content, spirit, within the first 15 minutes, we'd be looking at least one 200 word story going. And then by the 30 minute mark, there'd be another 200 word story. And then by the 90 minute mark, there'll be six briefs and so on, and two larger stories. And then by the 180 minute mark, and you can sort of see how that unfolds. Now, this actually works. So we've done this a number of times, and you quite rightly mentioned the fact that some councils are streaming their meetings. Not all of them are, but many are, which is great. So we've done that, and it's interesting, and this sort of goes to the need again. I won't mention the council in question, but it was a large council of a large regional city, more than 80,000. So it's been supported by a large media outlet. That particular council meeting, we identified, 22 items on the agenda that we would cover. We did so. We ran this model out. We actually identified a number of larger pieces that would go with it. We ran it in real time, just like this, and it was a really good result. But what happened was, assessing what happened by the local media outlet on covering the same council meeting, they actually produced one story from a press release. That's it. Where we had almost 30 from the same meeting, and they were good, legitimate stories. So that to me illustrates that there is that need, I think, and they were good stories, by the way. So where we're at next is a roadshow around the councils to try to bring them on board, turn those that interest into something more substantive. And then at the same time, try to get some MOUs from, numerous media outlets. So that now is unfolding over the next couple of months. I've already presented and pushed a whole bunch of, collateral towards the Local Government Association of Queensland, whom are extremely supportive, plus their members are, and they've got 77 councils that are really interested in this. And we want to take this around the country. So
we can look out for that. That's going to be happening this year, I take it?
We're doing that over the next little while. And, one last thing is, where could this go, beyond councils? You could take the same approach to state government and federal government, reporting in the same way, but with a really strong regional lens over it, because there are many media outlets in regional Australia that simply don't get the access, that they need from state and federal government. They get press releases from head office, and that's about it, from the government's head offices, and that's it, I think we can do better, and I think these communities deserve better.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. We have a question that's come in from the audience about paying contributors in terms of employing freelancers or people who, write for Galar or work for Public Interest News Service. The question is, will you be paying them appropriately? Is there going to be some sort of workplace agreement? Will you be liaising with the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance to come up with appropriate rates for paying contributors?
I can pick up the public interest one if you like.
Please, Tony.
Because I've thought through this. Yeah, absolutely. I'll be looking at freelancers who are of like mind, who are willing to, you know, sign up to our publishing mission, have the skills and the training that we would provide, you know, have the capacity and the willingness to do that, because the quality of what we're doing is absolutely imperative. So I'll be looking for people, you know, with that mindset. So it's not just a matter of, oh, are you available? They've got to be the right people, right? With the right sensibility, and willing to be trained.
And covered under that award, the journalist award?
Yeah, under the Australian Published Media Award.
Simon, thoughts from you?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, we're early stage startup. We piloted our model in these communities, three communities. We're going to have journos in each of those communities. We pay them award rates, of course. We're also going to have some contributors who are going to be not necessarily all professional journalists, but people who are going to create content that accurately reflects the diversity of the communities that we're serving. It's a big part of what we're trying to do is serve really diverse communities. So, yeah, absolutely. Our intention, of course, is that we want to build a sustainable business model that can then pay our staff. And, you know, part of our model is around, particularly in line with the co-ownership piece, is full transparency with our audience. We want to be, you know, we will publish our salaries, we will publish our accounts, we will show people exactly where their money is going. And we think that that is a way of building trust with communities who are maybe skeptical of some of the ownership structures and frustrated maybe about where some of the money is going, that their advertising dollars is kind of going within the organization.
So advertising is part of your model as well, yes?
Yeah, we've got three major revenue streams we're going to test, and the co-ownership, the recurring revenue from the co-ownership piece is one of those. We're also developing a brand partnership. We're not going to have banner ads, MREX, flashing ads. We're basically going to work with just a number of, a small number of major commercial partners who are really interested in the problem that we're all trying to solve, how to effectively reach and serve local audiences. I know maybe I'm deeply concerned that some of them that we've been speaking to are around the lack of options to reach regional communities in this instance. You know, we know that a third of Australians live in regional areas. Only 10% of the national ad spend goes there. So certainly working with some closely aligned brand partners, and it'll be like a toolbar across the top of our app, across the top of our website, rather than lots of flashing ads, autoplay videos, etc. And then the third piece is a data information product that we're going to basically offer to a range of customers, which is basically insights that our audience are sharing with us around the issues that they face. And we believe that actually, that will give us a powerful insight into the community on day one, on day 365, in time as it changes when our reporting serves it. And that insight, that data information, the data information market is a $3.3 billion market in Australia and growing fast. Whereas, as we know, the legacy media publishers are chasing their tails around looking for like less than $1 billion now of display and classified advertising. So we think data is a powerful currency. And if you're building a technology business in 2022, you should be obsessing about the data. We think that there's commercial opportunities there as well.
I would definitely think so. Annabelle, to you, is advertising ever going to be in your magazine? Is it no forever or not?
Well, yes, we are going to experiment with a small bit of advertising in the next issue. So we've had zero advertising so far. And I also just want to add that we do pay our contributors. I'm really proud to say the first issue I asked for people who wanted to contribute something, and that made it clear I couldn't pay. But now I'm very proud to say we work with about 40 photographers and writers, and we pay them. So that's really important to me. That's a really important part of the business. So back to advertising. We're going to just dabble in it. We're going to dip our toes in the water. And we are, are you still there? Can you hear me?
Oh, we're all still here, yes.
Oh, great. Sorry, something changed. So it's It's a path that I wouldn't have gone down if I didn't want to grow the business. So we could continue as we were, as we are with the three magazines, and we have a sustainable business, three magazines a year, and we have a sustainable business. But I've got all these big ideas, you know, membership models, tech that needs to be funded, all sorts of things. This, in this next issue, it's just we checked with our readers. We're always asking our readers, doing surveys. 70% of them said that they wouldn't mind advertising. 20% said they wouldn't mind as long as it was thoughtful, you know, and it was curated and kind of promoted regional businesses. You know, I think they just didn't want to see their like 20-page spreads of, you know, anyway, no need to name names. So I am going to give it a go. I mean, what I would, I think the best way advertising might work with Villa would be to, sort of what Simon was talking about, working with a brand partner. So a bigger business, say someone like Telstra or Rabobank, someone who cares about connecting regional Australia and kind of doing it that way. I sort of see that booking ads, you know, lots of ads for every issue, that's a job in itself. And we're such a small team, and I don't want to allocate our resources to sort of chasing down ads. But we're going to experiment. But yeah, we'll see. I mean, I'm open to it all at this stage.
I have another question for you, Tony, from the audience. And it's this: it looks like it's a great concept that will stack up, but what do you do when there's a huge doubt in the chamber where rogue councillors call for the CEO's head? Will that content ever see the light of day, especially if the other local outlet isn't there? We've all seen puff pieces with the mayor front and centre, but that appear in paid advertorials in news outlets. Fair question.
No, fair question, but let me say that it absolutely gets covered. You know, so this is, to be clear, the Public Interest News Service is not a mouthpiece for the councils. The councils are paid, the payment from councils comes from the distribution and the access to the independent content that we would create. So it's our content is protected by its own editorial mission. That we're upfront with the councils around the rigor of our journalism around our content. So as I said right at the very beginning, this isn't about giving councils a free kick. It's about giving them a fair go. And so they're going to get good and bad, but they've got to be treated fairly. So it's about journalism in context, right? So and that's all they can, you know, that's how it works. I've worked in, you know, when I was at AAP, we created or we provided news services to major sporting bodies, the AFL, Cricket Australia, and all those sorts of things. And they had their own media outlets, right? Their own media teams. They took AAP content because they could see the trust and integrity of that content. There's nothing different to this, you know. So everyone gets the optics of it. You know, if you've got something that is impartial, independent, well done, is fair, balanced, accurate, then that's it. Once you cross the line and move into that thing where it is just seen as a puff piece, well, then it's all over Red Rover.
This is another question. This one is for you, Simon, and it's along a similar line. How do you propose to manage potential conflict of interest from those who buy in? Anyone who lives regionally knows that those deeply invested in their community and therefore likely to buy in would wear multiple hats locally. They might be a local councillor and a big employer and president of the netball club.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, we have a charter of editorial integrity, which is visible, and everyone, you know, within our staff, and you know, it's been visible to all the people who've invested in our business so far. It makes it very clear that, like, you know, as, you know, our editorial operations are effectively a ring fence. Our community will have visibility around you know, the output and what we're doing, but ultimately they won't, and we're asking them to participate and share their insights. But ultimately that's done in a way where we're trying to do the best job of serving that community by hearing from a myriad range of voices and making that visible so that people can understand other people's perspectives. So the power of one individual or even a group of individuals, if there was maybe a group who became co-owners, our business model is based on we need 1,000 co-owners in order to come to a community, right? And so we think that actually that basically means that however powerful an individual might be within the community, that they're not going to necessarily be able to do anything. And also They're not buying, although they're paying for the masthead and they're going to have ownership of it locally, they're effectively buying. We have an entity that all the co-owners around Australia, we're not going to have cooperative structure. We're not going to have lots and lots of these structures. They're all going to buy into this one entity, PS Media, the local company. So and therefore their ability to control it, you know, it was very ring-fenced. We obviously, you know, in that example, we would report if there was, you know, a paedophile in the netball club or if the councillor was involved in embezzling funds in the way that any network, any news organisation would. And the fact that one individual might be part, you know, will not, of course, impact in any way in terms of how we would report that.
It's not about buying and being co-owners in a particular publication in a regional area or a regional town, but it's buying into PS Media, which is more a national entity, I understand.
Yeah, we've looked at a lot of models and we looked a lot at some very successful, particularly in Europe, cooperative media models. And there's also amazing membership models, which have really inspired our model. There's a huge amount of really exciting work that's happening on membership globally. But for us, when we looked at the models and we've worked with some lawyers on this in great detail, and some of it is the way our states and territories are set up, it made much more sense. Our plan is that we have basically the parent company, which basically builds the technology, employs the journalists, does the commercial deals and manages the newsrooms, you know, which are mostly remote. And then the co-owners buy in into the local company, which is ultimately the vehicle where the co-ownership revenues come in and where the profit goes back into. And there's an agreement whereby there are, so it's kind of like, you know, not influencing the parent company, but it gives it that company is where the profit distribution happens when we reach profitability in the future as well. So yeah, we thought hard about the mechanics of that.
And being a co-owner doesn't necessarily equate to being like a major shareholder.
No, every individual, whether you're a billionaire or, you know, somebody, a teenager who's really keen to have this because they think that they'd like to know what's going on locally, has an equal say. They're equal co-owners. You know, we have a separate group of investors, which will probably grow because we need to raise more capital to build this product out after these pilots. But that's a separate kind of, that's in the PS Media kind of cap table versus the local business as it will be when we're live in Australia.
A question for you, Annabelle. Two questions actually from the audience. What's the gender skew for the Galah readership? And you may or may not want to answer this. How many subscribers do you have?
Oh, no, I'd love to answer all of this. Okay, so gender skew, it's about 90% female, 10% male, but according to extensive surveys, sort of on average five sets of eyeballs see each mag, and, you know, just anecdotal messages coming in. Oh, my husband's read it. He's loved it. I mean, we are very intentional about making this magazine not just for the female audience. So I hope over time, it definitely sort of looks like a lifestyle magazine from, you know, for all intents and purposes. But I think over time, as people get to know it, more men will be interested in reading it, because a good story is a good story. You know, we're not doing beauty products or fashion. You know, it's definitely more about the culture and creative and, you know, things like that. So that's interesting to everyone. Now, subscribers, it's really interesting. So our first print runs for 1, 2, and 3 were 8,000. We sold out of those completely. Our print run for issue 4 was 12,000. We haven't completely sold out of that yet, but we're looking really good. And then proportionally, I think it's about 40% are subscribers, about 50% are sales either directly through us, through our website, or with our kind of branch of stockists. So we have sort of created our own distribution network, really, with, you know, every regional town has a beautiful shop that sells, you know, books and homewares. Not every regional town, lots of regional towns do. Yeah. Many, thank you. And so we thought, well, this would be a really good place for Galah to be sold. And so we've sort of got over 100 stockists through that. And then the remaining 10% is sold through news agencies. And I don't like the news agency model. I think it really irks me that any unsold magazines are thrown in the bin and they go to landfill. And it's just standard. It's heartbreaking. And so you pay for, you know, you pay for every issue, every copy to be distributed, but you only get paid on copies that are sold. You know, it's just the model. It's the model that exists. But then the news agents, it's too expensive to send the magazines back. So they just end up in landfill. And it's, 2022, and I just don't think that that is a sort of business that I want to have. So hopefully we can just phase out the news agency as we go on. And I think we're in pretty good stead at the moment.
It sounds like it. And the person who asked the question also agrees. This is a question for Simon, and I'm conscious that we have about another 10 or 15 minutes left in this session. So if anyone does have questions, I encourage you to get them in so that we can ask our panellists. Simon, have you started the pilots already, or are you about to start the pilots? And if so, do you have results?
So the physical reporter on the ground in the community, no, we have not started. We had plans to be started by now, and then a little thing called Omicron came along, which rather impacted on our ability to get our ads up and get started. But no, that's imminent and will be happening in the first half of this year. And we've had hundreds of conversations with people in the communities that we're going into, and we've been building. Our model is really about listening to start with to the community. And so what we've been doing is listening very deeply to the communities, as wide a representative group of people within each of the communities as we can, to understand what are their information needs, what are the deficits there, what are the gaps, what information do they need that's not being provided, what is the state of their local media, and we're really focusing in on places which are the described news deserts, places that have lost papers in recent years. And so that approach is around deeply understanding that and then reflecting that back to people. And basically before day one, being really in a position to be able to do some journalism we hope will be kind of profound and resonate, because people will have already bought into it, the participation process. And so what we want to do is, the pilots are really about proving out that, media can take a longer game view than just, chasing around the latest story of the day, and can focus on how can, if we understand the community in totality's issues, how can we deploy journalism to actually have impact on those things over time? And it won't happen in a week or a month. It certainly won't happen through the period of our short pilots. But what we want to do in the pilots is assemble kind of a roadmap for change that we think journalism can enable, not on its own, because journalism needs to provide scrutiny to power and to help in the way it historically has done, to try and drive positive change within communities. But we think that, harnessing the community's views, we can do a powerful job of trying to make people's lives better and solve their problems.
Look ahead 2 years into the future, and where would you like PS Media to be?
Surviving and thriving, in a post-pandemic world, where our revenue streams are growing, and we're scaling fast. We've built a product that, from a technology perspective, is something that we can offer it to any community in Australia that wants it. That we're in a position to have delivered something. Our ambition is to create something that, at the local level, for individuals and communities, is making a profoundly positive difference. But what we actually believe is, looking at the landscape within the media environment in Australia, that there's an urgent need for a kind of grassroots, and for the voices of local, whether that's in cities or in the regions in particular, to come up into the national arena. We don't think our biggest news groups do a particularly good job of actually surfacing the range of opinions around issues in the national arena. In a previous job, I had an office in Parliament House, and I know that so much of it revolves around those few hundred journos in Parliament House. In the bubble, and the PMO and to the various lobbyists. We want to actually take the views of Australia in aggregate into that arena and try and, that's the ambition. So I hope we'd be underway with that and starting to create journalism of real impact.
Maybe you'll be using some of what Tony is offering in some of those publications as well.
Very keen to talk to Tony about what he's doing, yeah.
So, Tony, 2 years' time, you're about to go on a roadshow to sell this concept more broadly to local government. Where would you like to be in 2 years' time? How many do you think you would like to have signed up?
It'd be great to be, have national coverage in that time. I think ultimately, though, where would I like to see it be? Not owned by me. I think it needs to be owned by the media industry itself, owned and run effectively by that, because I think that's it's. This is, I genuinely think that, you know, a public interest service like this needs to be, it's about the greater good, right? So it really needs to be handed over to a an industry body. That's how I'd like to see it play out. And I really think that it has the capacity to do so. The other thing, you know, this is, you know, it, at launch, it's about local council meetings, however, an important local council coverage, but for state and federal government reporting as well, done in the same way, I think could have, you know, amazing value, bring amazing value to regional media generally.
Annabelle, I'm sure between now and 2 years, you will have had 50,000 million new ideas. But where would you like Galah to be in 2 years?
Well, in 2 years' time, you know, I would like to see Galah printed on paper that is made from agricultural waste, like straw, not from trees. I don't know why we're cutting down trees to print this, you know, and print's such a luxury these days, you know. So I see no reason why we should be cutting down trees to, you know, indulge in this luxury.
That sounds like a landline story.
Yes. Yes. Well, please do, because paper from straw exists anyway. But it's a matter of convincing, you know, printers to have the paper that they can do in those big web scale things. So there's that. Our readers have told us they want podcasts, they want events. So we're definitely going to look into all of that. We'll have our first book out, and I hope that's the first of a series of books. So, you know, that's the beginning of that. But I think most importantly, I just want, in 2 years, I want Galah to be this voice from regional Australia that is trusted and that also is out there just to say that there's more than droughts and fires and floods. There's more than farming. You know, we're human beings living very diverse, complex lives. Some of us are artists, some of us are business people. So, you know, I just want Galah to represent that, and fundamentally to represent my own personal experience of how exciting life is in regional Australia. You know, it hasn't been this sort of second tier life. You know, I moved from the city to here, and I hope Galah can be one of the voices that gets that message across.
All of you have articulated some very innovative ideas, and, you know, to go back to using that word bold, which I used earlier, it is very bold. So it sounds like, you know, green shoots, milk and honey returning to the regions. What if milk goes off and ants get in the honey? What is going to prevent you from reaching your goals that you want to do in the next 2 years, Simon?
Well, you know, we have we believe that what's required is you know, a real sense of innovation, right? So our value proposition is different than anything out there, and therefore we need it to resonate. We need people to get it. We need people to actually. You know, we have seen some very encouraging signs from research that we've been doing that there actually is a great interest in different models of participation, of ownership. But we need that to resonate. We also need, of course, our journalism to actually have real impact, you know, because people will no longer continue to support us, or, you know, we want to grow. So we won't grow unless our journalism is actually having impact. To do that, we need to make sure our operations are super efficient and that, you know, we have healthy finances. So all of those things are things we will need to juggle around. And, you know, I think we basically feel, I think that this is the right kind of time for innovation in media. It's urgent, overdue. You know, I think that there's a whole load of possible factors that present risk. You know, we might not find enough people who want to be involved in this thing. We know, we've heard today that there's issues with hiring people, despite the loss of people to the media, that media is not something necessary that people are beating on the door to kind of work in. There's factors that are going to prevent obstacles. But, you know, we are powered by a sense of optimism and an understanding that we feel there's a need there. So we hope that we're going to be able to move around any obstacles that come our way.
And risks for you, Tony, what do you think they are?
That I've overestimated the need for, you know, the councils to be involved. I've overestimated the willingness for media to take it on. I don't see it that way, obviously. I do really believe in this project. But, you know, I think the next few months is actually going to be quite telling. I agree with, you know, Simon and others, assessment of the journalism or journalists out there willing to take this stuff on, and the war for talent. So, you know, part of this is about growing talent, growing your own talent as well. So that's got to be a part of it. So that will be an obstacle, but not something that is insurmountable in my view. But really, it's about understanding the appetite and turning really good conversations into something substantive. That's where it sits right now.
You don't see that there are numbers of journalists who have been misplaced, disrupted in the disruption, that they would want to come back? Or because you're looking at experienced people, not junior people, aren't you?
No, absolutely, absolutely. I'm involved in a number of projects. It's not just this one, and recruiting for another project, which I can't talk about at the moment. But, if you get the principles right, if you can tout that, if you can really... I'm finding that experienced people are actually drawn to that. So if it's about real journalism, if it's about journalism with integrity, there is a definite appetite for that. So that's why I stick quite closely to these principles, and that to me is what is required here.
Annabelle, and lastly to you and your 2-year vision, where will Galar be?
Where will Galar be? Well,
I know we have covered that, but what's going to prevent Galar from being what you want it to be?
Oh, well, do you know what will prevent it, I think, is if I run out of energy.
Well, I don't know if that will happen to you. It might happen to mere mortals, but not to you.
No, but, I mean, that's the risk of any startup, isn't it? These tiny teams and they just come down to a few people. But already our team is growing. Sarah Barrett, she's an ex-lawyer, ministerial advisor, she came on full time, so now there's Sarah and I. Already it's just starting, the sort of energy is starting to spread onto other people, which makes me feel really happy. And in terms of obstacles, I mean, I don't know what they're going to be. I just know there will be obstacles. There always are. But that's no bother. I mean, you just find a way over or under or around them, or flip it upside down and have a go until you work it out.
Too true. We have no more questions from the audience, but I want to thank all of you, the three of you. You are, make the rest of us mere mortals feel quite inadequate. You have amazing ideas, and I wish you all the very best in writing and creating many more new waves in regional journalism. So thank you, Annabelle Hickson from Galar, Simon Creera from PS Media, and Tony Gillies from Public Interest Newsroom Service. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy.
And thanks to everyone. Thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to Walkley Talks podcast with me, James Gorman. You can find links to the stories mentioned in this discussion in the show notes. Sign up to our newsletter at walkleys.com/subscribe to be the first to learn about our new episodes, events, and other opportunities. If you've enjoyed this episode of Walkley Talks, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. And while you're there, please take a moment to rate us. This podcast is produced by Andrew Herlinger with help from the 2SER studio in Sydney, Australia.